Thank you very much for coming today. We have two back-to-back candidate forums. And before we get started, I've got an announcement concerning the next meeting, which is on Wednesday, October 11. That's going to be back-to-back candidate forums involving, first, the supervisors' candidates for Samuel Miller District, and second, the school board candidates for the Samuel Miller and Ryo districts. Because that is a lot of work, and because there is a combined Board of Supervisors school board meeting scheduled for 3 o'clock that day, we're going to start at 1. We will notify you, but please make a note, because given the parking situation, if you were to arrive around 1:30, you would probably not be able to get in. Let's go over briefly the ground rules concerning the two candidate forums. The order of proceedings is going to be introductions by the moderator, opening statements, questions from the audience and the moderator, and then closing statements. Each candidate will be permitted 5 minutes for an opening statement and 2.5 minutes for closing statements. The candidate who makes the first opening statement will also make the first closing statement, and I right now have to flip a coin for you guys to determine who's going to go first. Tails. Steve, would you rather go first or second?
Second.
Okay. Questions from the audience will be submitted in writing on cards that are available. These questions should be addressed to all candidates and should address state government issues, not federal issues or United Nations issues or purely local issues. And now we'll start in our first candidate forum today concerning the 25th House District. The candidates are incumbent Steve Landis on my far right and Angela Lynn. Steve?
I thought I was going second.
Oh, well, you're. This is too hard to keep up with. Angela?
Hi. Well, I'd like to see all of these wonderful people here today who are interested in politics. And one reason that I'm here today is because I became more interested in politics after I got a very good view of how our politics in Virginia work. I did that by going to UVA Sorensen School for Political Leadership. But in addition to that, like a citizen as yourself, I was attending town hall meetings, and those town hall meetings told me that my representative had other people speaking for him, and that comes in the way of money to our state. So when I wanted to have a clear vote on something that was important to me back in 2013, there was no one else on the ballot except for the incumbent. So I think we have a problem in politics in this state of Virginia when we don't have people who are capable of or able to challenge an election with fair and open elections because of things like money and gerrymandering in our state system. That is one of the main reasons I decided to be a candidate, because I was going to bring this and other issues to light. So today I'm here again, because I think one of the most important things to do is not quit. I'm not a quitter. I've never been someone who stood back and didn't say something when it needed to be said. I'm always the type of person, and people who've worked with me know this, I don't follow a crowd. I follow my conscience, and I vote for what is right and for taking care of all the people of Virginia, and especially I'll stand up for the most vulnerable in our state. So again, I'm back in 2017 because I think we have issues and concern that need a voice, and I am that voice. So I thank you for being here today. I hope that you have a good understanding of the issues and the differences involved in what could be for the state of Virginia in a better political system that represents everybody. Thank you.
Well, thank you all for being here. And let me first thank the senior statesmen for hosting us once again. This is always a great event, a great opportunity, and I've enjoyed coming to not only these forums, but other invited opportunities that the senior statesmen have had. It's been my fortune and great fortune and honor to have served in the Virginia House of Delegates now for 22 years. I'm serving my 11th term. And the thing I've learned over those 11 terms is that the challenges that face Virginia continue to grow. They don't get any easier. But we do need people, as Angela said, we need people engaged in the process. And I really appreciate those of you that took the time that maybe not are members of the senior statesmen that came out and are offering questions. And I look forward to those first and foremost, because I think that will allow us the dialogue and be able to show both candidates where we differ and what we think how Virginia should be governed. I also want to just mention that we have had some success in Virginia. You know, in this day and age, sometimes we talk about the negative. And, you know, when you've got a challenge, when there's an issue that hasn't been solved, obviously it can be looked upon in a negative way. But I have always tried to approach things from a philosophy of looking at it from an optimistic standpoint and looking for solutions. And have tried to do that in a bipartisan manner, and working in the General Assembly, working with local governments. And I think that's the best way for us to serve and to represent individuals. We've had success in education and education reform. I'm very fortunate to have been involved in that as chairman of the House Education Committee. We have more to do. We've had success in economic development and bringing more jobs for the young people that are coming out of our K-12 system and higher education system. But there's more to do, and we can make improvements. And last but not least, we've also had some success in looking at reforming our healthcare system. Now, we don't know what's going to happen in Washington related to the Affordable Care Act or other things, but we know there are things we can do in Virginia, and we've been successful in trying to do that in the General Assembly. And I'm grateful to have been involved in those issues as well. But, you know, the most important thing I think for any representative is to listen to people. That's why this forum is important. That's why I have had town meetings every single year that I have been in the General Assembly, to meet folks face-to-face. And I'm always willing and always have an open door for individuals that want to meet with me individually about any issue. Sometimes that's harder than easier the more our schedules and busy schedules get filled, but I'm always happy to do that with any individual. I've also had legislative surveys every year that I've been in the General Assembly to seek input from individuals on various issues and to actually get you the responses, which I think is important, to let you know what not only what you put down, but what your fellow citizens put down and what was important to them. And then last but not least, I think from the standpoint of listening, another thing that's important is just to listen. You know, in this day and age with talking heads and politics, sometimes people like to talk more than they like to listen. And I think I've hopefully been able to demonstrate through those mechanisms that I just mentioned that it's my job to listen to the individuals that vote and that are citizens in the 25th House District. And then I also need to remember that that includes Albemarle and the parts of Albemarle that it entails, but it also entails, you know, other parts of the district, including Augusta, where I live, and Rockingham County. And then trying to balance all those things that people are concerned about related to the issues that face them in their locality and that they're concerned about from the state standpoint. So with that, again, thank you for being here. Look forward to your questions, and it's been an honor and privilege to represent the citizens of the 25th House District.
Steve, you'll answer the first question first, please.
Okay.
Delegate Bell has a bill known colloquially as the Tebow Bill that would allow homeschooled kids to participate in their local public schools' athletic teams. Do you a favor or oppose that bill, and why?
I have voted in favor of that legislation. In fact, did not favor it originally, but worked with Rob as he had that legislation go through the committee I actually serve on and am now chairman, to allow homeschoolers that pay taxes, both locally and state and federal, and to allow them the opportunity to have their children play on organized sports teams in our high schools and middle schools. I think that's important that they have that opportunity. More importantly, I don't think it would be as disruptive as some have said, but I also believe that we need to see if it works or not. So I worked with Rob on the legislation he had to have a five-year trial period, if you will, to see if it would have the impact, positive and negative, that some of the proponents and opponents have said. And Rob was good enough to agree to that, and that has been, that amendment has been on there a good number of years. And I hope that the next governor may look at that favorably and try that and see how that works, because I think it would be a good opportunity for the homeschool students, and I don't think it would be disruptive. And actually, I think from the public school standpoint, it may encourage homeschoolers to actually want to participate and go to the public schools.
Angela?
Well, to begin with, I agree with Steve that it would be good if the homeschoolers got a chance to participate and be able to go to the public schools. But what I don't agree with is all of the draining that's been done from the public schools. I don't believe in public funding to go to any private entity and drain any of our public school funding, which has been happening with the bills that have been introduced, either through charter schools or from the Tebow bill to a lot of things that are going to come down the line from the Betsy DeVos plan. I am not in favor of that plan. I am in favor of the public schools being fully funded and not draining them in any shape or form. And I will be adamantly against anything that takes away from public funding and gives it to private entities. In the sense of athletics, those are funded through our taxes, but they are also meant for our public school children to be able to participate under the VHSL rules. Those rules would not be able to be applied to someone who doesn't go to our schools. I welcome children to be able to participate together to have some more sports. I have been a coach. I have been a mentor. I have been a AAU tournament director in the state of Virginia, and believe me, I like sports. But I also like public. Public is not a bad word. It's a good word, and when it comes to our schools and opportunities, I don't want to see them defunded in any shape or form.
Steve, do you have a further comment?
Let me just say that the issue, I think, is whether the student should participate or not. I think the question with the legislation is it would basically tell the VHSL, and I actually happen to be on the executive committee of the VHSL as the chair of the House Education Committee, that they would allow the students to participate. Actually, in talking to VHL staff, they think this is probably going to occur. It's happened in other states, and they see this as something that probably eventually will happen.
Can I respond to that, please?
Yes.
Well, as Delegate Landis knows, being the chair of the Education Committee, when you don't have a child enrolled in the school, you lose that money. And for those children that are not homeschooled, that's money to the state to that particular school district. So not having them enrolled loses money to that school. So again, I do not believe in doing anything that defunds our public schools. And if it's in different types of endeavors, it's still going to cost our schools funding that they can't afford right now.
The next question goes first to Angela. Please state your opinion on the adequacy of K through 12 education funding and what you would do about it.
Okay. Right now we have a issue and concern with fully funding our schools. The schools are not funded. From 2008, there had been a lot of cuts, and each student now is down about $400 per student. So when I was called by superintendents in the other counties, not Albemarle County, because that's where I live here, and I know that a lot of the people on the school board and the superintendent, I'm familiar very well with the Albemarle schools, but in the other areas of the state, in Augusta County and Waynesboro, I was asked to come in by the superintendents who wanted to talk about how the schools are not being funded and how 300 bills are constantly introduced, but nobody is asking the superintendents how those things that are coming down from Richmond are going to be implemented. They're paid a good salary. They have PhDs, but nobody seems to be able to speak to them about what is happening in their schools and how the funding has been cut. We have a teacher shortage. We are not going to be able to find special education teachers in the state of Virginia. The schools do not pay the teachers well. But in addition to that, we're not talking to our school boards. We're not talking to our superintendents anymore. And these are things that have been on the front burner with these school districts, who the people in the rural areas like their schools. They want them to have the communication it deserves from Richmond, and they want the funding.
Steve?
Well, let me say that I have individually met with superintendents and do it on an annual basis and more frequently as needed, and they let me know very well about what they like, what they don't like, and during the General Assembly session. So I'm not sure who we are, but it's not me. I will tell you that education funding is a priority from the General Assembly standpoint. We actually funded $18 million more than the governor had in his budget this past biennial budget amendments that we made. We're investing $15 billion of direct aid to public education. We also reestablished the proceeds and sending $91.3 million back to localities with more flexibility to allow them to use the funds that they would see with no strings attached. So we're making progress. The other issue about funding for K through 12 is it's also a responsibility of the locality. Some localities do better than others, but it has always been a shared responsibility. Sometimes I think people get the impression the state is the only one that's providing funding. So we also have to partner with the localities in making sure that they can make the investment that they need to as well. And I will tell you, some of our school systems struggle at the local level, and the state's trying to pick up the slack where we can. We've helped Petersburg, we've helped Richmond, we've helped rural school systems. And we're very fortunate in Albemarle, Augusta, and Rockingham to have strong public school systems. But there's also a finite amount of money when you look at the state budget. And unlike our federal friends, we have to balance the state budget. But it's still a priority, and it's over 30% of the state budget that goes just to K through 12.
I would like to just point out that the reason Albemarle County has good schools is because we do have a healthy income, and we have a healthy income because of our property taxes combining with our income tax. But if Delegate Landis' office says that he is a supporter of Gillespie, and if we end up with a 10% cut in income tax, that means we're going to have to find that somewhere, and they're going to find it through you. We're going to find it through you, through your property taxes, through your cell phone tax, any little tiny tax you have right now, meal taxes. These are things that have had to come back for taking care of our schools, because we have to have a healthy tax base. And if you're going to cut 10% of the income tax, then it's going to come from, to fund those schools, property taxes. Again, we can't afford to not fund our schools. But in addition to that, these hidden taxes that we have already are the things that are making us constantly look at where are we going to get the money to actually have the quality schools that we need and we have in Virginia. And it's been through these hidden taxes.
Steve?
Well, let me just say that you have to grow the economy. If you look at John Kennedy and you look at Ronald Reagan, they cut the tax rate at the federal level. It spurred economic growth in the 60s and 70s and in the 80s and 90s that other presidents benefited from. And so the tax plan that Mr. Gillespie is proposing makes sense. But it's also being phased in. So as the economy grows, the full 10% would be phased in, but not until the revenues come back in to recover to make sure that it can be covered and to be done fiscally responsibly.
Next question. Charlottesville and Albemarle have had for about 30 years now a so-called revenue sharing agreement, under which the city undertakes that it won't annex any part of the county, which it can't. in exchange for approximately $15 million a year in county revenues. What is your position on the revenue sharing agreement, Angela?
Well, to begin with, I know that Delegate Landis had tried to introduce a piece of legislation that would have had ended that revenue sharing, but that would have affected other localities that have had this revenue sharing for over 200 years. So at some point, he had to walk that back. Now, he had to walk that back because it is something that has been, in other localities, a dependency on getting a whole litany of people together that have agreements on how they're going to pay for things that are beyond one locality's jurisdiction. He said that he did that because of his constituents. But his constituents are the same constituents that our supervisors have, that our school board have, that the city council has, but they weren't even in on this piece of walking and overreach from the state level to end the revenue sharing. And I think that that was a big mistake, and that's why he had to walk it back.
Steve?
I don't represent the city of Charlottesville. I represent the citizens, or part of the citizens, in Albemarle County. And a vast number over the last 5 or 6 years have asked me why this unfair revenue sharing agreement has been allowed to continue, given the fact the General Assembly basically has said that annexation is null and void. It's a null and void contract, in my estimation. And yes, I did attempt with a budget amendment, not a piece of legislation, to stop that revenue sharing program because it is unfair to the citizens of Charlottesville. You're paying $16 to $17 million that could be used for public education, that could be used for public safety, that could be used for many other things that are priorities of the citizens of Albemarle, not Charlottesville. So, yes, I did make an attempt, but I did have to back it off, and it hadn't been 200 years, but maybe 50 or 60 years where revenue sharing agreements have been in place, and it would have been too broad. And that's why I did back it back, because you have to be realistic, and you can't impact other localities when you're not intending to do that. But if I'm reelected, I plan to look for a way to do something along those lines. Delegate Bell has made attempts, and I will have made attempts and will continue to do so, because it's unfair. It's not fair to the citizens of Albemarle County.
And
again, I would like to point out that that is government overreach. That is coming from the state to the localities, ignoring the localities have agreements because they have people who have put them in place through their voting. Voting, again, is the most important issue here today. We have to have more participation because we cannot have fair and open elections with only a few people voting. And if we stop voter suppression and stop the gerrymandering that's going on in the state, then we will end up with good participation, and things like this, government overreach from the state level, won't happen.
Well, let me just say that the revenue sharing agreement was between the two localities. The problem is the county is stuck. They can't get out of it. Every locality in the Commonwealth of Virginia is a creation of the General Assembly of Virginia. You look at any flag or any seal of any local government, and they have a date on it, 1793, 1739, whatever it is from the creation. You know what that date is? That's the date the General Assembly of Virginia created that local government and empowered them and continues to empower them through state statutes. We're not a home rule state, and that's why the General Assembly has to act on behalf of local governments and their local citizens.
Next question. Do you favor or oppose the Virginia law that requires you to present a photo ID in order to vote? Steve?
I've supported legislation to make sure that we have secure ballot access for our citizens who are legitimate and registered voters in the Commonwealth. And I think that's important. A secure and protected voting system is important. For the citizens to make sure that the actual people that are voting are the folks that are eligible and should be voting, not individuals that are not eligible to vote. It also, with our close elections in many cases, is important that the actual folks who are registered and are citizens and, again, eligible in those areas are the ones that are actually electing their representatives. That's how our system was set up. We've made improvements to it, and we need to make sure it's seamless, and we need to make sure it's easy for people to not only register but then to go vote. But a photo ID, when you have to provide that for every other thing that you do as a citizen, whether it's going to go into your child's school, whether it's going to cash a check at your bank, is not an onus burden on individuals. We also came up with other means, if you will, of identification that you can use, and are providing free photo IDs to individuals who don't have driver's license or the other IDs that are qualified for going to the polling place. Now, one of these days with technology, we'll have facial recognition, and the voter registrars will have that for the election officials at the polling place. But until we get to that point, this is a way to make sure we have a secure ballot that everyone can participate in, that is eligible and a citizen.
Angela?
Well, let's just talk about why voter IDs would not be fair to all populations of people. Who would it actually hurt? It actually hurts people who are minorities, people who have two jobs and can't get to work and take care of their children, and not on that, they have no papers because maybe they have had to move around quite a bit to locate all those papers, to help them with their children, to get them to the photo ID place to take that ID and get that done for them. That takes legwork and volunteers, so it does hurt the people who are not really represented well in the General Assembly, and that would be women and minorities. That is the population that this hurts the most with voter suppression. So in addition to that, we have a very low problem with fraud, but we have a bigger problem with participation, and that's what we're gearing towards. I would love to see the Face ID, new technology, easy technology to vote, more people voting, because that actually would give us a good test of what are we doing and who are we representing, and is everybody being represented fairly and equally, because the vote is the one thing that makes us equal. It crosses over socioeconomic lines. It knows no boundaries with race or gender or any of those things that make us feel that we aren't as powerful as another person. But if we're not all capable of being able to do it, then that would be stripping us of a fundamental right and a pillar of our democracy.
Steve?
You know, for many years, My colleague here and others that I know in the General Assembly and the Democrat Party have said that there is no problem with ballot security. No problem. We had reports and have gotten reports since that there were 5,000 people at least in the Commonwealth of Virginia that voted that were not citizens of the United States. And therefore, they were not citizens of Virginia. And they voted in elections. Now, my good friend Mark Openchain can tell you how important elections are. He lost to Mark Herring by about 160 votes statewide. Out of 8 million people, not that many registered people, registered voters in that 8 million, but out of a state of 8 million people. So ballot security and actually having people who are citizens, who are the ones that are supposed to be deciding who their elected officials are, is very important. And that's why photo ID is so important.
Can I respond to that? Okay. With the amount of people that are participating in our elections, I'll just go back to 2015, our election, when we had an off year, another form of voter suppression, because we really do tire people out having an election every year, don't we? And in addition to that, we had 53,000 registered voters in our district. Of those, only 19,000 voted. I would say that is not a good population of people who are actually being part of the conversation. And I would like to add that the polling places not being available to some, split precincts, lines. There was lines during the primary and during the presidential election that were 30 minutes long, sometimes 45 minutes. I saw grandmothers hanging on to their kids, their grandchildren, who were crying, and they wanted to go eat, not stand in a line. I know that a lot of moms that I go to their door and ask them if they're going to go vote, it's very difficult for them to say they're going to be able to do that because they really don't have the time and they really don't have anybody watching their kids. These are things that we could solve and not worry so much about a handful of people that are in a opposition to everybody voting.
I guess I get one more shot at this. Let me just say that I do agree that we need to make access to polling places, reducing split precincts, all those things is a good idea. The problem is people can either decide to go vote or not.
Yes.
And we cannot, and I will not, make people go vote. It's their decision whether they want to. Let me tell you, as a candidate and as an elected official, I encourage everyone to go vote as much as possible and as many elections as possible, because that's important as a citizen.
Next question. Do you favor ending gerrymandering in Virginia? And if so, what is your preferred route to that objective? Angela?
Well, I had the fortunate privileges of being able to serve on the regional board for One Virginia 2021 here, and also I was a public speaker for One Virginia 2021. So I'm very familiar with this issue in Virginia, but I have feelings that are deep because I have been involved with looking at how it's hurt Virginia in our own state by being the fifth most egregious state for gerrymandering. It doesn't serve the public to have districts that are drawn for the favor of the incumbents. With the incumbent protection, along with the money with gerrymandering, we have had little or no movement with those districts because they're hard to beat. They're not only hard to beat, some of them are impossible to beat. So when the legislators are drawing their lines and they're favoring themselves, we have cut the voters out of the conversation. I am very much opposed to gerrymandering, and I feel that the bills that were introduced this year and were not supported again in the House District, in the House Privileges and Elections Subcommittee, they were bundled and they were excused before the vote took place. These are the shenanigans that keep going on so that this cannot get to the floor. And yes, I know that Steve introduced a bill, but then he didn't support that bill. When David Siscano had that same language on that bill and asked for people to have a vote that they could see who really wants to advance to end gerrymandering to the floor, he voted that he didn't want it to advance. And then when the Senate had three bills come down, the Privileges and Election Committee, again, Steve voted against ending gerrymandering in the state of Virginia. So I'm the candidate that will end this and give the voters back their rights to have a fair and open election.
First of all, in the 2015 election, I did say and have supported efforts to look at criteria and the change of criteria that we utilize and how we utilize that as part of our process. And I think the General Assembly should do that, and I think that that's important. And in 2016, introduced a bill to try to accomplish that. It wasn't successful. 2017, introduced the constitutional amendment to try to accomplish that. Very simple language that would basically codify or put rather in the Constitution that political considerations and the like should not be part of the process when trying to do districts. And I think that that's important. Now, Angela wants to be a member of the House of Delegates, and I think that's commendable. But you also have to understand how the process works. The bills were not bundled. They were put together in a block to vote on, and they were killed. Every subcommittee, every committee can vote things up or they can vote things down. I've been in the House for 22 years, and I've had some successes, and I've had some failures. But I keep trying when I've had failures. And sometimes you look for another thing to work on because it's just not going to pass. And I'm not sure. I think redistricting reform will come about at some point in time. The bills that Angela mentioned that came over from the Senate were not like the ones I had voted for in the past, and I actually liked my version better than the Senate versions. So I did not vote for them because I didn't think it was appropriate. One dealt with an independent redistricting commission, taking the responsibility out of the General Assembly's hands, your elected officials. You don't elect the General Assembly to not do their job, and that's part of their job. And so I didn't vote for that. And I've said time and time again, I don't support that. But I do support redistricting reform and have voted for the legislation and put legislation in to try to accomplish that, as I promised in the 2015 election.
Angela?
Well, again, I'd like to point out that when we have a vote and it has a district that it doesn't look like people are in the same counties that can actually have anything to really compare why their representative is why they have a representative that's 40 something miles away. For instance, 25th district, it starts in the end of Albemarle County, but then cuts around Waynesboro because that's a large population of people they didn't want, around Stanton and goes all the way to the West Virginia border. I've sat in people's barns. I've talked to them in their business places. I've talked to them in their homes. They've never had a politician come to talk to them before, and they told me that they want to end gerrymandering, that it's ridiculous, but also incumbent protection, because 22 years in office is too long. They want to be able to have somebody else.
Well, you know, with 22 years comes experience, and I hope I've tried to use that experience to the benefit of the citizens of Albemarle, but the 25th district actually goes from the city limits of Charlottesville to the West Virginia border. And I agree, it is a long district. But I also agree that once you are elected to that district, it's your job to try to represent it. And that's why I'm here today. That's why I've tried to come to Albemarle on numerous occasions. That's why every election year I go door-to-door to talk to voters. That's why I've had town meetings, I've legislative surveys, all those things I mentioned, because it is my job to listen and to try to represent the citizens. And there may be people that think that 22 years is too long, and they will have a chance to vote for my opponent. But for those that have liked the service that I've tried to provide and that want to see me continue, hopefully they will vote for me for reelection.
Next question will have to be the last question. What do you propose to do legislatively or otherwise to address the problem of statues to Confederate war heroes? Angela?
First off, what legislation would I create? I absolutely feel that we are in a new era of recognizing that racism has never really been dead. It has always been here, but we have new reasons to believe that now we have to deal with racism, not statues. Statues aren't the issue. We could get rid of every statue and we'd still have racism. And that is the problem. And I think that that is what we need to concentrate on. So if we can have a bill to get rid of racism, I'll introduce that.
Well, let me say, if Angela introduces that bill, I would be glad to co-patron that legislation. Because she's right. The problem, the root problem is racism and people not in their hearts understanding that everybody is a human being. It doesn't matter what your skin color, what your background, what your nationality. We're all human beings and we all have equal rights and should have protection under the law and should all be treated with respect. You know, the issue of statues is difficult because, you know, unfortunately, Virginia was the capital of the Confederacy. And I think we need to learn more about that. And I think people need to understand what our founders and what the individuals that served in that conflict on both sides, what they did that was appropriate and not appropriate. And I think our young people need to understand that. But Angela's exactly right. We need to do more to get people to not accept racism and discrimination against anyone, because it's not the American way and it's not the Virginia way. And it hasn't been for many, many years, and I'm glad that Virginia has changed. I had the great opportunity, I think Angela did too, where we've grown up in the era where we had integration, where everybody's accepted and given the same opportunities, and we need to continue down that path, and we need to support policies and legislation to accomplish that.
Angela?
I'm glad that we both agree on that. I think the most important thing is some people don't feel that they've been given the same opportunities because of oppression, and oppression comes in different forms. And because of that oppression, they feel that they have been ignored and they continue to be ignored, and that these are the things that we all want as a human. We want to have an education that gives us opportunities. We want to have employment. We want to be able to have an upward mobility. We want to be able to be treated as equals. But if that's not happening for people, they know their truth. I believe their truth because they're living it. Who's to tell me what I know has happened to me isn't so? Because it did. So I believe them. I think we need to work on it, and I think oppression is real, and we need to solve it.
Again, I agree with Angela. I think, you know, the key, and this is a perfect example, we've had a civil discussion about issues that we don't always agree on. And the problem in our society now is that people are yelling at each other and not listening to each other's viewpoint. And that's what this, you know, discussion has been about. And we need to have more of that, and we need to promote opportunities. And I think it's incumbent upon us, not only as elected officials or candidates, but we need to make sure the tenor is civil and that there's respect for individuals and respect for people's viewpoints, even when we don't agree with each other. And I think the more we do of that, the better off society will be. And I think you'll get better government in that way. So thank you all again.
It's now time for closing statements of 2.5 minutes max each. Angela?
Well, I'd like to point out that I didn't step up to run for office because I thought it would be fun. I'm not doing this for kicks and giggles by any means. I really am the candidate for the 21st century. I don't believe we need to go back. I think we need to go forward. And how we go forward is how we treat our people today and the new issues and new concerns that are being addressed when it comes to income inequality, when it comes to things like our health care. Health care should be for everybody. There is no one that can be happy without a healthy and sustainable income. When you're bankrupt because you cannot afford your health care, then what good is your job? What good is your life if you can't afford to be able to get to work or help the people around you who need to be able to go to the doctor? These are things that are being faced right now. Our wages are pathetically low. We need to raise the minimum wage because we are, what the surrounding states, the lowest. $7.25 is a tip. That is not a wage. We need to be able to have people work and be able to meet their needs. That is something that we are working on as a group of people to be able to give everybody the opportunities. In the rural areas, they need to be able to see a future. They need to be able to do that by having jobs come to that area. They're not going to come to that area if they're impoverished, if our schools are bad. If we don't invest in them, then those people, the farmers, tell me that their kids won't stay. They want to be able to have that $59 billion industry in our state be sustainable, but the farmers are constantly under attack. When I've talked to them, they know that they have no control over the eminent domain and also the things that are happening that threaten our lands, our forests, and our farms, and our natural resources. So this is the candidate of the 21st century. I'm paying attention to these issues. I'm not taking money. I'm a threat because I cannot be bought. I will not be manipulated, and I will not allow more money into politics and more from the outside sources telling Virginians what to do. Virginia is not for sale, and neither am I.
Steve?
First of all, let me thank the senior statesman once again and for all of you all being here. And you've been a great audience. You've been respectful and you've been attentive. I've been looking around the room and I can see nobody's gone to sleep as far as I can tell. So that's good. Let me just also say that when I first ran, and the reason that I ran is that my parents, and my father's no longer alive, but my mother and father told us when we were growing, I came from a family of four, that we should be giving something back to our communities. And this has been my way to give back. I've always seen this as service and public service, and I've tried to approach it that way. I've also tried to use the experience that I've had to for the benefit of the citizens, whether it's working through problems that they're facing with state government or trying to get in touch with other representatives, especially at the federal level or locally. And I've tried to work hard to do that. And then I've also tried to get results based on what people are telling me and what they're asking us to do. I will tell you, I'm not a big fan of just putting in a bill or passing legislation just because someone wants to have their name and get some credit for it. If it means it makes a difference in somebody's life, if it means it improves society, if it means it improves our public education system, or reforming health care, or actually brings jobs, then I've been involved in those issues and tried to put forward legislation to do that. And I've been very fortunate and had some success. But it's been for the benefit of the citizens of the 25th District, not because Steve Landis did it or because another member did it, but because it's what the people wanted. And that's why we like to call the House of Delegates the People's House. We have a two-year term, so our contract is every 2 years. Let me tell you, you stay in touch with your constituents because you know your time is up every other year. And that makes us be in touch with the folks we represent. And I've tried to do that. And it has been an honor and privilege to represent you that are in the 25th District. And I hope and ask for your vote to be able to continue that service for another 2 years. Thank you all.
Please join me in thanking Steve and Angela for a wonderful forum. This is the second of our two back-to-back candidate forums today, and this involves the candidates for the 58th House District, incumbent Rob Bell and challenger
Kellen Squire.
Kellen, would you make your opening statement first, please?
Sure. Hi, everybody. My name is Kellen Squire. I'm an emergency department nurse at Martha Jefferson Hospital. I want to thank everybody for being here today. I want to thank Terry for moderating, for Mr. Bell for agreeing to be a part of this, and all of you for being here. I mean, you took time out of your day to exercise your civic virtue. This is a sort of sober application of the democratic process that I think we don't see enough of these days. And so it's a little surreal to be on this side of it and more than a little humbling. So thank you, everybody. So I've served our community since moving here from Roanoke to attend the University of Virginia, not just in the emergency department, but in pediatric acute and intensive care at the University of Virginia Children's Hospital, as a school nurse with the Admiral County Public School District, and at Elson Student Health Center at the University of Virginia. And as a nurse, we're kind of trusted with a unique position in our community because nurses are considered the most trusted profession. And so we treat people when they're at their most vulnerable. They come to us expecting us to give our all unequivocally. It doesn't matter who they are or where they come from. We don't color, creed, religion, political affiliation, sexual orientation, it doesn't matter. We take care of people. The only criteria is whether you need our help or not. So I think that's why the election last November affected me the way it did. And I'll be honest, I don't care who you voted for. It was not the sober application of the democratic process. I think that I, certainly not what I was raised to believe is supposed to happen. People so nasty with each other. It was divisive, the partisanship. You know, you had neighbors against neighbors. You had family members that couldn't talk to each other at holidays. And it was just not something I could stand idly by and let go on. So, you know, nurses aren't really akin to sit around and do nothing. If we see something that needs to be done, we stand up and do it. And so I realized I could just sit around and bellyache about on Facebook, or I could stand up and try and do something. And that's why I find you before me today. So.
Terry, Rob? That couldn't have been 5 minutes. And yeah. You were told we'd have five minutes.
Say,
can he have some more time?
It was pretty quick.
No, gosh, no.
Five.
Yeah. So I was trying to give you more.
Thank you.
Trying to give you more time, not the other way around.
Whoa. It's like it was a fast 5 minutes. So
it feels faster on this side sometimes.
So I decided I could sit around and bellyache about it, or I could stand up and try and do something about it. And that's why I'm in front of you today, is because I decided to do that, to stand up and fight for things like expanding Medicaid coverage for 400,000 working Virginians. Because it's not just a good idea from a budgetary perspective or smart policy. It's our moral obligation. It's a matter of life and death for some people. Fight for a smarter approach to the opioid crisis, not just checking boxes or lip service, but really going all in to save an entire generation of Virginians who are in danger of disappearing from our society entirely. Fight, shout, holler, scream until every Virginian has access to the 21st century economy, regardless of their zip code, until we've expanded broadband internet to every school, farmhouse, holler and hill in the Commonwealth of Virginia, and until we make sure through a reinvestment in our public education system that all people from all walks of life, regardless of their circumstances, have the opportunity to access the educational opportunities they need to power their own success. And probably most importantly for me is to end partisan gerrymandering. I lay that at the woes of our republic now. And I'll be completely honest in here. There's just as many Republicans and Democrats that are guilty of that. So if I get sent to Richmond, I'm going to end that for everybody. I know they talked about that in the last debate, but we do need to take that out of the hands of the General Assembly building because, again, I don't care what letters in front of your name. The indication are, if you are given that power, that you abuse it. You use it to make sure that you're neither accountable nor responsive to the people that you're supposed to be representing. So, you know, my campaign slogan is people before party for a reason, because I think if you poll about 90% of the citizens of the United States of America and you ask them whether either the Republican or the Democratic Party can put people before party, they would laugh at you. And that's a problem. And, you know, I hate politicians that promise you the world and don't deliver. And I said I would never be that way. But if I get sent to Richmond, I can promise you that unequivocally, I will be a fighter for the people of the 58th District before anything else. Thank you.
Rob?
Everybody, good afternoon. My name is Rob Bell. I'm this current delegate to the General Assembly from the 58th District, and I'm running for re-election. I want to thank the senior statesman for having me back. This is our, I don't know how many times we've done this, but it's the latest time. Thank you. And I want to thank Kellen. This is much harder than it looks, and we both were just chatting. We have young kids, and those young kids don't see us as much as we would like. And it's it was Bill Clinton who said that you're forever changed if you have to walk up to someone and say, I would like your support and vote for me. So, well done. Congratulations.
Thank you, sir.
All right. I want to talk for a little bit about some of the things I've worked on for the last couple of years, and then talk a little bit what I'd like to do, and then get right to the questions. So, as most of you know, I worked as a prosecutor back before I got elected, and many of you have been coming to these since my first election. And the issues that I work on generally fall into some themes. And so the first one is I have continued to work, as I did then, as I have in years past, on sexual violence and domestic assault issues. And I want to go through some of the bills that I've patroned or written on that topic. The first is we had a problem with protective orders in Virginia. Historically, they were aligned to women who were married, who have kids with somebody. And as we saw in the Yardley Love case, that's not the only place where violence occurs. And so a few years ago, I had a bill that dramatically expanded the availability of protective orders. It covers not just boyfriend-girlfriend, as took place in that case. It also covers neighbor-to-neighbor, workplace violence. And the goal would be a protective order can at least sometimes stop the violence before it gets worse. That was the goal that passed. The second is we took up stalking. Stalking is when somebody does something over and over and it's scaring you. And one of the problems with stalking is we had a fair number of cases where it's usually the guy. The guy would say, well, I'm not trying to scare anybody. I'm just trying to show that I want to see her. I want to be there. And he shows up 10 times, 20 times, 40 times, calls over and over through the night. And we said, well, gosh, he may not be intending it to be so scary, but it is scary and intimidating if you keep getting those calls. And we looked around the whole country and discovered that South Dakota had solved this riddle. And what they said, in retrospect, is simple. They said, well, let her decide. And if she puts them on notice and says, I don't care why you're doing it, it is scaring me and intimidating me. And if you do it again, it's stalking. And that's the new law of Virginia. We changed that a couple of years ago. The third was, of course, after the terrible Hannah Graham case, we had a look at campus safety and campus security, because if you remember, what happened to Hannah had already happened to Morgan, and perhaps sort of even worse, had happened twice before in other colleges that had never been reported. We also talked to survivors and victims who said the support services are not sufficient. And when something happens, I don't know who to go to. I don't know where I can go to get honest advice that doesn't somehow end up in the wrong hands. And so we passed the bill, and this was a bipartisan effort. Give Dave Toscano credit. We worked together. And what it said would be two things. We said, first, we will give them the information they need to get the support that they want. And then number two, if a college administrator knows about certain kinds of sexual violence, so the more serious kind, the kind that's likely to reoccur, they have to report it to law enforcement. We've got to get that to the cops. And that passed. And then the last one was one that I was not the primary actor on. That was Terry McAuliffe's wife, Dorothy. And it was these perk kits. And I don't know if you read this, but a perk is where they go to the hospital after a rape and they collect all the evidence. And the best evidence, of course, is the DNA from the perpetrator. And often the victim doesn't know what she wants to do with it yet. And so instead of going right to the police, they put it aside, and there was no mechanism. And we found thousands of these untested perks. And the problem was, of course, with that DNA, you can actually pursue the case. You can get a cold hit. You can find out what happens. You can connect two cases, like in the Jesse Matthews case, one in Fairfax, one in here. And so I carried the bill in the House. There was a Senate bill. And again, give Ms. McAuliffe all the credit to get all of those tested, and then further to make sure that it doesn't slip between the cracks again, to make sure those perk kits get tested going forward. So I'm real proud of that. Now, the second broad category is crimes against children. We have an ongoing issue, of course, that crimes committed against kids are harder to prosecute because kids have a hard time testifying. It's just they don't come forward and say, someone did something awful to me. Often they think it's their fault. So we did a few things. I had a bill a few years ago. I worked with children victim advocates. And what was happening was we had complaints that were ending up at CPS, not at law enforcement. So instead of they go to CPS is Child Support Services, they do the investigation. As social workers, some of these cases are bigger than that. And so we wanted to make sure that the information gets to law enforcement so they could pursue it. We're also trying to address human trafficking. Human trafficking is child prostitution, terrible thing. We wanted to make the penalties bigger for the guys who do it. And then, of course, it all comes from money, so that when you have someone who is hiring a child prostitute, we want to put them on the sex offender registry. That passed a couple of years ago. And then last, we had an issue that came out of PVCC. PVCC had a sex offender who was on campus. The sex offender registry only covers work and where you live. And they contacted me and said, gosh, we didn't know he was here. We've got homeschoolers here. We've got high school kids here. We've got grade school kids that are coming on campus for camps. We really need to know. And so we changed the law last year to make it possible for that to be in the sex offender registry so parents can find it. I see the light is red. I've also worked on mental health issues with CREDES as part of the Deeds Commission. I'm happy to talk about that further if it's one of the questions that's presented. And thanks again for coming. Thank you.
The first question contains a representation as to what is in the Virginia Code. But since it concerns Title 18.2, I know Rob is familiar with it. That's the crimes and offenses. The question is, Rob, it's to you first. Virginia Code Section 18.2-287.4 currently prohibits carrying loaded firearms in public places, but only applies to certain areas in Northern Virginia, Tidewater, and Richmond. In view of recent events in Charlottesville, would you support amending this law to include Charlottesville and Albemarle County?
Okay. So he's giving more credit. I cannot cite that code section from memory. I apologize. I could look it up. So I'll answer the question more generally, if that's okay. So I do not support expanding limitations on law-abiding citizens who wish to have guns to defend themselves. I think that if you look at the problems, when someone is smaller, weaker, a firearm can give them the protection they need against someone who's bigger or more aggressive. So I do not support expanding those limitations. Thank you.
Kellen?
So if I understand, it's saying that it's giving localities that, or certain jurisdictions, the power to enact rules of themselves, or?
It empowers certain jurisdictions to enact laws, ordinances, that would prohibit the carrying of loaded weapons in public.
So I'm of two minds on this because, you know, even Thomas Jefferson, when he founded the University of Virginia, forbade the carrying of firearms on the campus. And I'm always sort of a give power to localities as much as possible. You know, I know advocating against the Dillon Rule has been something Virginia politicians have been doing for eons now. But I really feel very strongly about I don't like cookie cutters. You can't tell me that there's a solution that will work in Fluvanna or Rockingham or Charlottesville. I mean, it'll work across the board with everything. But, you know, I think that if there are localities that want to do things like that, that they should have some power to do that. And we can do that while still respecting the Second Amendment. I feel about that very, very firmly. So,
anything further, Rob? The second question will go to Kellen. As you're aware, there's a revenue sharing agreement between Charlottesville and Albemarle that's been in effect for more than 30 years now, under which the city gives up the power it doesn't have to annex Albemarle County property in exchange for approximately $15 million a year in revenues transferred from the county to the city. What is your position on that revenue sharing agreement?
I'm not a fan of the way it's structured, although I'm not sure. I mean, again, Delegate Bell can probably tell you better than anybody that I think there's a good bipartisan consensus from places around the state that want to make sure that it's in their best interest to make sure that that revenue sharing thing doesn't go anywhere. So Rob or Angela or Steve or whoever can advocate vociferously against it, and it's like, sorry, guys, you're stuck with it. But it does. It hurts our local schools. Like, not only are we losing in Admiral County, the Admiral County Public School District is not only losing that money, but it gets accounted against them. So it's like a ghost $15 million that they get accounted for in their budget that the General Assembly is pretending that they get. So, you know, it's definitely a problem, and I would love to be able to tell you that, you know, it's something that I would go and charge in and fix. But again, I guess I got to be honest because it's going to involve buying in a lot of other jurisdictions around the state. I do think it's something that needs to be addressed, though, one way or the other.
I mean, does anybody understand how bad a deal this is? No, I'm not being funny. I mean, so this was passed back in the day, and as a result, it gives the city of Charlottesville a percentage of every tax penny raised in the entire county. It's not tied to the area that was going to be annexed, which would have been a sensible way to structure the deal, where you say, we're going to get, and if you think about Rio Road, it's basically the Rio Road loop, so where Rio becomes hydraulic, it's that area, Seminole Square, places like that. They could have simply said, instead of that tax money going to the city, it's going to go to the county. And therefore, the city should get that money from the county. They could have structured it that way, and then going forward, no matter what they build in that area, it would make sense. It doesn't work that way. It works for the entire county, and it's forever. And so if you look in the year 2400, when we have a spaceport in Free Union, the city is going to get a percentage of that money. Now, I am not content to try and sit here, and I tried a couple of different ways, and Steve's trying a couple of different ways. I happen to think my way is clever. Let me tell you what I tried, and I'm going to try it again if we can't think of something else. The school money funding that you get from the state is tied to each locality's ability to pay. So Albemarle County is a 65. It's considered a wealthy county. Greene County is a 33. Greene is not so rich. What that means, though, is that it's based on the property tax value. What it doesn't take into account is that money that the county is sending to the city. So the city's ability to pay, the composite index is 68. They're already richer than the county is. But they don't have to take, we don't get credit for the 6 cents. 6 cents of your tax dollar goes to the city each year. At a minimum, at a minimum, I think the composite index should take that into account. The state is giving the county not enough money. It's giving the city comparatively too much. It's not an effort to hurt the city. I'm just saying the county deserves that money. I've got kids in those schools. So does Kellen. So do many of you or grandkids or something. That money takes away their ability to do things. Last, there was a time in all of our memories, because I don't see a lot of 18-year-olds here, where the city was poor and the county was rich. At least then you could say, we were transferring money, they need the money, we use their parks. It's no longer true, everybody. The composite index for the city is higher than the composite index for the county, not even counting this offset. So I think this is something that, now that this, the city will never do this willingly. Why would they, right? I mean, they have a forever contract. But this is something that I think is fundamentally unfair. The longer it goes on, the worse it will get, and I'll try to change it if I can. Thank you.
Do you have a further comment?
Good.
Next question will go to Kellen. What is your position on Medicaid expansion in Virginia?
I'm unequivocally for it. It's something that I see the need for. Thank you. It's something that I see the need for every day in the emergency department because we get people. So with Medicaid expansion right now, if you're truly indigent, you can still get Medicaid. It's for people that work. I mean, and that's the sort of bizarre thing to say. You work too much and you make too much money. I mean, there's supposed to be like, when you think of that, you're thinking like, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 a year. This is like $12,000, $15,000 a year or less, depending on your circumstances you're making, and you can't get Medicaid coverage. And the problem that we see in the emergency department is that robs you of the chance to, see a primary care physician or to do things like that. And so what happens with these folks is that they'll let, a chronic medical condition go, or they say, I can't afford my hypertension medication, I'm just not going to take it. Eventually, they end up in my emergency department, and they come in, and we have all sorts of interventions, and, they spend time in the ICU. And the problem is that right now in the United States of America, we have universal health care. It's called EMTALA. It's the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act. Basically, it says a lot of things, but what it says is, if you come to my emergency department, we have to treat you. And I don't see anybody advocating to repeal that. So that means that's the reason that, Christmas of 2014, I had belly pain, and nurses are bad for having hypochondria, like nursing-induced hypochondria. So I got a CT scan because they thought I had appendicitis. I didn't, but I had a $4,500 bill for the CT scanner, and that was the reason, was because we're paying for people that can't pay. Expanding Medicaid coverage, especially considering that 2 years ago, every major hospital in the Commonwealth of Virginia offered to pay Virginia's share in perpetuity. I mean, it just makes sense, and it's cheaper for everybody. I mean, when we can handle these things before they become huge problems, right? Like I said, unless you're going to repeal EMTALA, we all end up having to pay for it anyway.
Rob?
So I think everyone knows I oppose the proposed Affordable Care Act related expansion of Medicaid, but I want to underline sort of where we are and how we got here. In the times that I have been coming to see you, so since the first time we walked in this door, I have expanded, meaning I voted for a budget that expanded Medicaid past any number that you all would have come up with. And I mean that sincerely. So I've got the numbers here that Medicaid has grown by 722% in the last 30 years. It's growing at twice the rate of the rest of the budget. It's effectively doubled in spending in the last 10 years. Perhaps the most important and useful metric is the percentage of the state budget that it has taken up. It used to be 5% of our state budget. It was a sizable proportion, but it is by no means our biggest program. It is now 22% of the budget, and it is going to continue growing faster than the rest of the budget by far. What that means is every time that you all come up, and I hope we have some questions about other priorities today, and I'm sure we will, things like teacher pay or roads or some program for the opioid, all these various ideas that people have, those all cost money, and they might be good ideas, but right now the money is going to this Medicaid expansion. And I say that because the proposal to expand Medicaid that came down with the Affordable Care Act, even if you believe the money is going to come from the feds, greatly expanded the group of people. Now, that's the upside. In other words, what Kellen is talking about are the people that would get some coverage. But the impact, I think, on our long-term budget without more fundamental reforms and how Medicaid is delivered is absolute. And I have it right here. This was the numbers people run how the budget has grown since I got elected. So again, some of you were here my very first time 15, 16 years ago and have come every couple of years since then. And you see steady growth. So the aid to schools up 69%, higher ed up 38%. That's lower. We've shifted fees on to tuition. You have corrections up 49%. Medicaid up 263% in my tenure. So every 2 years, we have voted to increase it faster than inflation, faster than growth, faster than the rate of inflation plus growth. I think it is irresponsible to have another significant expansion without addressing these drivers. Thank you.
So 2 years ago, when we were considering Medicaid expansion once again in the Commonwealth of Virginia, every major hospital group in the Commonwealth, and I mean Sentara, University of Virginia, Ionova, Carilion, everybody got together and offered to pay the state's share of Medicaid expansion in perpetuity. So, which is something that, as far as I know, no other state in the United States of America got offered to, because that had been Mr. Bell, among other people's arguments for the longest time, was that we don't want to get stuck with X amount and it goes up and things like that. So these major corporations got together and begged the General Assembly to tax them to pay for it so that they could get it, so that they could offer, again, primary care services and things to people before it became an issue, and the General Assembly couldn't find a way to make it work. You know, we can talk about budgets and stuff, and it's certainly an argument that we need to have, but we have people out there that are hurting. We have more efficient ways to do it if we expand Medicaid than if we don't, and I don't think there's an excuse for not getting it done.
In Virginia, those hospitals have a government-enforced monopoly. It's a terrible proposal. I voted against that, too, but they have it. Does anyone think that that money was going to come from their bottom line or from the CEO's paycheck? Of course not. Of course not. Now, again, I've got no objection to what Kellen is saying. This is not the first time. I've been before you for years. We've had this very conversation, and that's fine. But to pretend that this isn't just going to fall right to the consumer who is already being buffeted by the increased premiums and other costs, I think is unrealistic. They were going to pass the cost right on through, and they were going to have to be paid by the patients. Thank you.
Can I have one more? Can I have one more? No? Dang it. Oh, well.
Next question. Do you favor ending gerrymandering in Virginia, and if so, how? By what route? Rob first.
So I think that when you are discussing how districts get drawn, there are a large number of factors, and I want to sort of run through them. This is from memory, so I might leave one out. The first would be, of course, do you want to make the districts competitive? Is that going to be your primary goal? If you want to make competitiveness the primary goal, there are places like our hometown, like Charlottesville, where the only way to do that is to slice it not even three ways, but four ways. Charlottesville, after Petersburg, is generally thought to be the most reliably Democratic locality in the state. The only way to do that is to split it up. That's a priority. You can say that's a priority. That's fine, but that's going to be the consequence. The second is called compactness, how much the district should stick together. Should it be strung along for long ways, or should it all be stuck together? Again, in many cases, that is directly the opposite of competitiveness. You can have communities of interest. And so my district includes both suburban Fluvanna and suburban Green. All of those people see Charlottesville as their center of gravity. That's where most of them work. And they also have a lot in common with my neighbors up in Briarwood. Different schools, but similar place. Rutgersville is very much like Briarwood. You can make that the issue. You can try to keep political communities together. So Albemarle has four different delegates. You could say we probably have a hard time making it two. You could probably make it three. You can make that part of the primary things you're looking for. You can look for split precincts. Now, what happens is different people redistrict at different times. The county does it at a different time than the state does. You can say your primary goal should be to track the precincts as designed by the city and county. Those are the kinds of things we should think about when we're doing redistricting. I think we need to have public forums, one after the other, so people can say either, here's my big idea I need, or here's the map I want you to do, or just, I'm sick of having Fluvanna be cut in half. I think those are all things we can hear. And I think we can get advisory opinions, advice, maps from any group that exists. So there are various groups that are advocating for various things. I hope they will send us all their maps. But when all that is said and done, I think it's the General Assembly's responsibility to actually vote on a bill, and that's what I support. Thank you.
Well, as I said in my opening statement, I think that I think legislatures have lost the privilege of being able to do that because they've been shown they can't be trusted with it. And I told you, and I mean it very sincerely, I don't care if you're a Democrat or a Republican. When you engage in that behavior, it just is so that you can shirk the accountability and responsiveness that that everybody in here deserves. So, you know, there's no excuse for not getting it done. I hear, you know, people say, well, it's really hard, or we go over some of the problems that Delegate Bell indicated, and it reminds me a lot of my 9.5-year-old when she doesn't pick up her room. It's like, well, there's always a good excuse for why you didn't get it done, but the problem is you need to get it done, and we have to. What I want to fight for is, like I said, accountability and responsiveness, and there's got to be a way that we can argue all day if we want to about how to get it done. But we have to, because, again, I lay the woes of where we find our republic today directly on that. You have things like Mr. Gillespie running for governor on the Republican side, who in 2010, bought the Internet search history of every citizen of the Commonwealth of Virginia to go through and draw maps maliciously for partisanship. It's just not, I mean, it's not acceptable. Like I said, we could talk about computers, we could talk about compactness, we can talk about, you know, and our district is, and it's very diverse. I mean, you go to Elkton, the people there, I mean, you talk to them, and it's like, it's even different than the rest of Rockingham County, right? They can point, they're like, that's where my house was, and they point up at Shenandoah National Park. I mean, they remember like it was yesterday. And to have those sort of diverse groups, it makes you consider different people in different parts of Virginia, which I think it should be absolutely the goal. But what it shouldn't be is an excuse either to stack majorities for either party on either side. And we need to do everything we can to make sure that that's not the case.
Do you favor or oppose Virginia's law requiring people to show a photo ID when voting? Rob?
I favor it. I voted for it. I was one of the people that worked on it. Let's talk about it. There was a canard for many years that there was no voter fraud in Virginia, and I hope that that was put to rest in the 2016 election as close as Harrisonburg. Of course, we just had a young man go to jail because he was registering fake names. And I hope you saw the story, because one of the reasons he got caught was unique. It was literally just an assistant registrar, who I assume was just working for the election, I don't know, who said, wait a minute, this name isn't that Judge so-and-so's dad. Didn't he pass? Well, they did. They unpacked it. It turns out, yes, indeed, that was a real fake person who was actually being registered and was going to be there on the rolls, you know, ready to vote. We have other issues in Virginia about being registered in multiple states. If you have moved from another state in the last 5 years, you likely are still registered in the other state. I had a bill this year that said to the governor, would you please just pass that information, because you have the information, would you please just pass it to the registrars and let them try to clean up the lists if they can, and the governor vetoed it. Now, the photo ID in particular, the issue has always been it has to be free. Free. True blue free. There was a Texas case that made it free, but of course the birth certificate cost money, and the court said you can't. No, it costs money. It costs money. It's poll tax. It's free. So the Virginia system is free. Now, we've always had a $10 ID you can get at DMV. I think most people know this. Now, I don't mean the driver's license, but right now you can't drive for some reason or your eyesight is going, you can get a really nice Virginia ID card for $10. But even that was too much. And so we put in place a system where each registrar has the capacity to make you an ID card. Now, it doesn't do much besides let you vote, but we have that ID card as a photo ID. It's the last check. Now, is it the only check? No. Do I wish we did more to cross-check the list against other states and against citizenship and all these other things? Sure. But it does at least mean that when the person comes into the polls, they have a photo ID to show that they are the person who's actually voting. Thank you.
So, and the case that Rob is talking about in Harrisonburg, and that young man did get jacked up, which, well, he should have. So what he was doing was he was registering, you know, like you said, fake names and stuff. The problem for that is nobody's been able to explain to me, as wrong as that is, with, absent some sort of Scooby-Doo hijinks, how you actually vote as those people. You know, like when I go to vote at Baker Butler Elementary School, the people there know me and they know that. I mean, it's I would have to come back in a disguise. We'd have to do some very interesting, you know, I try and figure out how that works. I'm not saying, again, you know, those registrations and stuff, people that that commit those crimes need to, because they're undermining our election system. That's fine. But again, I don't think you're going to find a lot of people that are voting that way. And as far as photo ID goes, I remember going to vote in person at the Admiral County Public Office Building in my scrubs with no wallet, because I rarely take my wallet to work, and just my hospital ID, which in theory is acceptable. But the lady there said no. She said, nope, you need your photo ID, you need your DMV issued ID. And, you know, I could have sat there and argued with her, but, you know, I have to get to work and things like that. So what I don't like is when that sort of becomes a backdoor way to discourage people from voting. Or, you know, like, if I wasn't committed enough to go back, and I know Delegate Landis is like, if people don't want to vote, they don't have to vote. And, you know, that's fine, too. But sometimes, like, you know, you had people like this last November. Maybe they were just disgusted by the whole thing and they didn't want to vote. But then the day before, something happened. And they're like, you know what? I need to exercise my civic duty and go vote. And then they can't. That's why, you know, if we're really concerned about things like fraud, we should do like what Oregon does. Vote by mail, automatic voter registration, get it done. We don't got to worry about it. You don't have to worry about voter fraud issues becoming up. Fixes it across the board and increases participation in our democracy, which I think we need to encourage.
Okay. Well, of course, the way you vote if you've got bad registrants on the list is you don't have photo ID. I mean, I don't know how complicated this is. If you have people that are dead, if you have people that are non-citizens, if you have people from other states, if you have people that shouldn't be on the list at all because they're not real, the last check is someone walks up, and when they say, I am, and I forget the name of the judge's father, Mr. Smith, I'm Mr. Smith, and the nice lady says, well, we need some ID, Mr. Smith. That's the point at which, if you haven't committed multiple felonies in preparation for that, you go out the door, you leave, you don't vote illegally. That's the goal. And what is troubling to some of us, so certainly there are delegates who go veto hunting. It's just fun. They think they get to go home and say, I got the most vetoes. I'm not one of those guys. And yet this year, I had this photo, not even photo ID, just this clean up the lists bill. And there were much more expansive ones. There was ones that say we need to do a citizenship check. I mean, there's double check against felonies. All these things that we thought we could do to make the list better. All mine said was, you assemble a list, Mr. Governor. You have it. You check what's called the cross-check system. We have 25 states. You check the list against each other to see if somebody's in the wrong state. You give me green again.
I know.
More time, or should I stop? That's fine. 30 seconds. Okay. But you have the list. There are registrars. Now, the original bill said the registrar has to do all these things. And the State Board of Elections said, some are so overwhelmed, we can't do that. I said, okay, fine. Let's just give it to the counties, and some of them will have the manpower, and some of them will know the people, and some of them will be able to clean up their lists. And he vetoed that, too. And I'm disappointed, and I hope that we can bring that back and hopefully clean up our lists in the future. Thank you.
If I register Donald Duck to vote, again, I should get prosecuted for that, but Donald Duck is not going to vote. I think that's the end of it. Again, absent some, like I said, some sort of Scooby-Doo hijinks where these people are committing, and that takes a lot of, I mean, that would take a lot of preparation and planning and stuff to go and vote multiple times, and enough to swing an election, too. Again, I think it's sort of a red herring. We can argue about voter fraud and things like that. But I think the way to fix it, like I said, is to emulate a state like Oregon, which has the lowest rates in the entire country and the highest participation.
This will be the next to the last question. Virginia is one of just a handful of states that allows unlimited campaign contributions, whether from individuals, corporations, partnerships, labor unions, whatever. Would you favor restricting or limiting that? Kellen?
Absolutely. I have to look at our most recent numbers. I think that we've had like 1,300 some unique donations to our campaign, and it's all come $20, $30, $40 at a time. And I've had to work hard for that, and it's really made me appreciate. I tell you what campaign finance laws seem like to me. So it's almost like corporations like Dominion or Super PACs, political action committees, lobbyists and stuff, it's like heroin. It is, because you work hard and you finally get in the General Assembly building and it's like, here's a $500 check. That's all you need. We're not going to ask you anything of it, just here's $500. You're like, that was really easy. You know, and it is. And finally you find yourself in a dark place where, you know, and like I said, my biggest fear in this whole thing is not losing in November. It's becoming the sort of politician that I've always hated and always railed against. I've seen better men and women than me corrupted by the system. That's why on things like gerrymandering and campaign finance reform, I think we need to take that out of the hands to keep people honest and make sure that they're being accountable to us. I'd be for like a robust, I would much, much better spend time like knocking on doors and meeting people and talk to people. Even people that, oh, actually that's some of my most favorite conversations is people that don't agree with me. Those are the best. And I've had to be yanked away from doors by my campaign manager, by people who clearly weren't going to vote for me because we're just having such a great time talking about it. And that's what I would like to spend my time doing instead of raising money. And then I would like to be accountable to the people that I'm supposed to represent only, and not corporations, not lobbyists, not any political action committees.
So I'm not rich. I don't come from any money. There's no one in my family who is well off. I've got an uncle who's done pretty well, but my dad was in the Navy. I don't come from the money. I can't afford to write a big check to my campaign. Now, there are groups that float around the political atmosphere, if you will, that swoop into places and write big checks to candidates to try to get them elected or defeated. And I think it's important that for someone like me to be able to raise money, and the vast majority of my money comes from our area, to have the money I need to run campaigns. Now, Virginia has something called a Sunshine Rule, and in fact, there's largely because of a private website called VPAP, Virginia Political Action Project, VPAP. We have some of the best, most transparent, lickety-split, comes right in reporting that is anywhere in the country. And I think it's important you can look at the money that comes in, you can look at our votes, you can look at what we spend the money on, in terms of you can see not just money that comes in, but money that goes out, and make your decisions about how you think that's impacting your legislators and their votes. And I think that's the way it ought to be. Thank you.
We do have a unique tool in VPAP, and it is outstanding. But nonetheless, you know, unlimited campaign donations to any, I don't care if it's a Republican or a Democrat. You know, I would like to know if anybody here honestly thinks that if somebody, and I don't care who it was, dropped me a $100,000 check right now that I would owe them, or that there wouldn't be some sort of tension there that would feel like I would implicitly owe them something. If anybody in here honestly thinks that somebody could hand me that much money and I could be like, oh yeah, fine, and I ignore them the rest of my life, I would love to hear it, because, you know, it's just not reality. And like I said, again, it's been better men and women than me corrupted by that system. Let's just keep it out of their hands. We just need legislators at all levels that are accountable to you guys and nobody else. I would be, you know, I'm not rich either. Some sort of public financing system, you get X amount, you know, to start. You can raise X amount over, in small donations. We can make it so, I don't know, the first $250 that everybody donates, even to local campaigns, can be tax deductible. There's lots of things we can do to fix it, and we need to.
Last question, and this will be for Rob. What is your position on the issue of sanctuary cities in Virginia?
Okay. So everybody understands what a sanctuary city is. It's when the local law enforcement doesn't cooperate with ICE when they try to get a detainer. So they have somebody that they think is illegally here. They would like to deport them. That person comes across the criminal justice system through some vector. They get arrested. They get stopped. What happens? I have voted several times to take steps to try to eliminate that. I do think that this is an aspect of law enforcement where we have someone who is not legally here anyway, and then they've gone further and broken the law that we should do more than simply treat them exactly like an American citizen in the same spot. Thank you.
So I think the police should have to follow the Constitution of the United States of America. I think it's important to note we don't have any sanctuary cities in the Commonwealth of Virginia. And I guess where my issue on this comes from, the federal government expecting the Albemarle County Police Department, for instance, to enforce federal law with no training, no funding, no anything like that. I mean, they're not even, that's just another, I'm not a fan of unfunded mandates to begin with, but that's a huge one. So let's start from right there. If the federal government was really serious about that, they would offer up, they would pony up some of that stuff, and you don't see it forthcoming. So, and I don't like to take, again, you guys have heard me say this time and time again during this forum, I don't like to take power away from local, like I said, Chief Lance of the Albemarle County Police Department, I want him to be able to run his department, make a rapprochement and rapport with the community where he feels it's a, rather than me breathing down his neck to tell him how to do his job. You know, I'll reiterate, we don't have any sanctuary cities, and the police need to follow the Constitution of the United States of America, I mean, unequivocally, which would include some of that, but, you know, we can't be solving the federal government's problems out of our pockets here in Albemarle County or Fluvanna County or Rockingham or Green, and the federal government saying, thanks, guys, thanks for doing that for us, and see you later. So.
We'll now proceed to closing statements, 2.5 minutes maximum. Kellen's first. Rob has advised us he has another meeting he has to go to. He has to leave promptly, so he has to dispense with after chatter. Kellen.
Thank you, Terry. Thank you, everybody in here again. This was outstanding. I mean, even with, you know, you get cheers and you get glares and stuff like that, too. But it's all really cool, sort of, again, to be on this side of again, you guys being here, exercising your civic virtue, listening to Delegate Bell and I discuss stuff. I enjoyed the sort of civil tone that I think we don't see that enough. And again, it doesn't matter what letters in front of your name. We don't see that enough in our political system today, and we need to, because I have not very positive views on where our republic will end up if we can't find common ground or at least be able to discuss, be able to disagree civilly with people. You know, again, as an emergency department nurse in particular, I work with a group of very strong people, very type A personalities, and we don't always agree with each other. But when, you know, people's lives are in the balance, we figure out a way to make that work. And I think that that is the sort of thing that we need in Richmond and Washington, everywhere in our country. So, again, thank you, everybody, for being here. Thank you to, again, Delegate Bell for being here. And thank you all. That's what I've got. God bless you all.
So, for better or for worse, y'all have been stuck with me for some years, and I would like to agree with Kellen that the tone in this room, if it were everywhere, would mean we'd have fewer problems in this community, in the state, and in this country. So thank you. I think that these are important issues, big issues, but we can do a better job of addressing them. Whether you agree with me 99% of the time or 1%, your input makes this for better decision-making. So I'd like to talk just real briefly. We never got around to mental health, and then I'll stop. There are issues that I'm not aware of any partisan divide. And mental health is one that we're working on. And just tell you two things we're doing just to leave you with some, if you're looking for some upbeat out of this. Cree Deeds has been a real leader ever since the terrible episode with his son. And the two things that happened, the first, if everybody remembers, his son was having a decompensation, got worse and worse, finally attacked Cree and then killed himself. And that could have been, if that had been me, I think that would have been the end. I would have quit. Cree has used that as a chance to try to advance a really thoroughgoing reform of the mental health agenda. We've done little things, like we set up, it's called the Bed of Last Resort. That was one of my bills. And it just said that if we can't find a place, because if you remember, Cree's son was brought to the police, and in 8 hours they couldn't find somebody, and he was treated, we're going to put you in the state hospital. It may not be a great idea, it may not be a permanent solution, but we will at least put you someplace safe until we figure out something better. And then we had a second episode down in Portsmouth where a young man was brought in as a schizophrenic, arrested on a shoplifting charge, brought to the jail. His paperwork got lost, and I mean literally in a drawer. He stayed at the jail 100 days and starved to death and died. Yeah. And he was in our hands, everybody. This was, you know, and jail is not a great place, but there's supposed to be people with, you know, badges who check in on you, and they actually had a doctor's service called NAFCARE. They're supposed to keep an eye on him. And he died. Michael Mitchell is his name, and his parents have been very active in trying to at least make that part better. Going forward, for both of these, we're going to try to find a way to divert, it's called diversion, we get as many people out of the criminal justice system and onto the mental health side as we can. And if the cop can do it that night, if it's somebody he knows, if he can tell right away that it's a mental health issue, we'll do it there. If it gets to the jail, so the guy's arrested, but 2 days in you say, oh gosh, he's floridly, he's schizophrenic or something really strong, we'll get him out. Or if it's just the court, if the judge can say, I need some options other than the options I have, it's something that we're working on. I think that this is something we can get done. If you reelect me, I'll work on it. I'm sure Kellen would pick up the cudgel if he won. But that's something we're going to work on going forward. I appreciate your time today. Thank you.
See you. Please join me in thanking Rob and Kellen for a wonderful candidate forum.